Listen.
Aye. It's the same skylark music we have back in Ireland, lass. Do you hear it?
Aye. A glockum or a skylark. You know, Mr. Mahoney, that old devil moon, it's in your eyes, too.
It is?
It takes two to make a valley legend. I look at you, glory be. Something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. It's that old devil moon that you stole from the skies. It's that old devil moon in your eyes.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, November 20th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, we have to I have to apologize for last week. Some of you may know that I was out of town, and we had planned to record a show and got up on Sunday morning, and the place that I was staying with had no internet access. It was down, and it took a few hours to get back up, so we missed the window of opportunity to record, and we missed you guys last week. So we have a double packed show this week with a lot of things to talk about, and we debated back and forth whether or not we should talk about this, but I guess we're going to have to because... the president has taken to Twitter again and is criticizing the cast of Hamilton for not apologizing. Now, we get caught up here. I guess it was Friday night. Vice President-elect Pence was attending Hamilton on Broadway. And while he came into the theater, there was some booing in the audience. And at the end of the show, the cast did a curtain call. During the curtain call, did a little plea to... Vice President Pence that to have an inclusive administration, and everybody seemed, if you're a Broadway fan and you're listening to this show, you know all of this stuff. I just wanted to get everybody caught up on it just in case they've been in the middle of nowhere and they haven't heard any of this, or some of our international fans. President-elect Trump has asked the Hamilton cast to apologize. And so far, there's no apology forthcoming, and it seems to have taken on a life of its own. So, Michael, you were right next door at the Great Comet on Friday evening. So tell us about what your impression was of this thing.
Well, I feel like I was, again, sort of on the periphery, at least, of political history, because before I was seeing Natasha Pierre at the Imperial. And before the show, I noticed that Tom Viola from Broadway Cares was in the audience, and I said hi to him. And it turned out that after Natasha Pierre, he was headed over to Hamilton because this is one of the times of the year when Broadway Cares does their collections after the show to aid their very good works. And so I'm not sure everyone realizes, but this this political plea at Hamilton was actually part of that, that regularly scheduled plea from the audience for funds. So it's not as if they just, decided to talk during the curtain call for the specific reason of Mike Pence, and I'm not sure how much difference that makes, but I just wanted to get that on the record. So I saw, it was so funny because I saw Tom before Natasha Pierre, and you know, we just said hi, and I'm not dreaming, you know, what's going to happen 2.5 or 3 hours later. And then after Natasha Pierre, which we will talk about on a subsequent podcast, because I know Peter and I saw it, but Josh Groban was out sick for much of the week, and he'll be back, and then we'll give you a full report on that. I loved it, by the way. But anyway, afterwards, I stayed to speak with Lucas Steele, who's an old friend of mine who has one of the leads in Natasha Pierre. And I was with Giuseppe Bozzilio, my friend who is going to be in Hello, Dolly! And was recently in Cats. And he knew people in the show. And so we spent quite a bit of time talking with those people. Natasha Pierre is not as long as Hamilton. So by the time we got out and we exited at the rear of the Imperial Theater, which is on 46th Street, and we notice all this activity right next door at Hamilton. We had apparently just missed Mike Pence leaving, but there were still some protesters there. And then it turns out Giuseppe has a friend who I'm not going to name her just because I didn't ask her ahead of time, but she's a very, very smart, talented young theater journalist. And she was inside, and he was texting her, and because he knew she was at Hamilton. And he's like, "Where are you?" And she said, "I can't talk now." It turns out she was the one who did the video that was seen around the world of the speech that Javier Munoz I'm sorry, Brandon Victor Dixon, right?
Yeah, Brandon Victor Dixon.
Brandon Victor Dixon was the one who actually gave the speech. And the reason that this young woman did it was because she had gotten a call from Jeffrey Seller saying, "We need you to be here because something's going to happen." And they didn't have anyone else available or whatever. And she wound up doing it. And so while we were texting her from the street after all this, she was editing the video inside the theater on her phone in order to, you know, send it around the world, which is where it went. So that was kind of amazing to be there while all of that was happening. And as far as the more general divide of opinion as to whether it was appropriate for this speech to be made, I would have to say in most normal circumstances, maybe not, but these are highly unusual, very, very, very dangerous circumstances that we're in. And so a lot of bets are off.
Peter, so what's your take on what has happened here at Hamilton?
Well, for one thing, Joe DeManowitz from the news yesterday called me and said, "Do you have any idea if this has ever happened before?" And I sent him to Tom Bogar. Tom Bogar is the author of a book that's actually called American Presidents Attend the Theater. Mm. It's a two-volume set. Goes all the way to George Washington.
Two-volume set.
Absolutely. He talks about George Washington loving the School for Scandal all the way up to, I think it was the second Bush. But anyway, Tom Bogar says, to his knowledge, this has never happened, that a president or a vice president has been booed. So let's get that out. I agree with Michael. These are very perilous times, and I'm not surprised this is happening, because what we certainly learned from this election is that we should be two separate countries, given the fact that the popular vote was so close. So I think the speech was extraordinarily eloquent, astonishingly eloquent, as well as even tempered. And it was more of a plea than a demand, to be sure. So I think under these circumstances, everyone's well within his rights. This is still America. We can still say what we feel. But it certainly is symptomatic of something that's going on. So I'm not really surprised to have it happened. And I think we're going to have more of this happen. And I'm not sure that apologies are really called for under the circumstances of the person who's calling for the apology, because there are a lot of apologies that could be given from a lot of people in this country. So opinions were expressed, and I, for one, am glad they were. We have to keep on top of this. We have to make sure that people know how everybody feels, and so be it.
Two words have been used in Trump's tweets, harassment and and rude, and neither one of those applies remotely, regardless of how you feel about the whole thing. So just wanted to get that on the record.
It seems as though that maybe all the information has not made it back to people who disagree with the Hamilton cast. That
there's a first. You know, people not bothering to find out what actually happened before making a decision on their opinion.
It needs to be clarified. Probably not for our listeners, because we probably are more plugged into the Broadway scene than most other people are, that the Hamilton cast did not boo the vice president-elect, that it was in the audience, some folks in the audience booed Vice President-elect Pence.
Some people also cheered him for whatever that's
And worth. Some people also clapped and cheered him as well. And that, as you mentioned, the plea at the very end was, it was happening in every theater across Broadway. Maybe not those specific words, but it was probably custom tailored for that particular audience that evening. I think that I read that Lin-Manuel Miranda and Jeffrey Seller had their hand in writing that little speech for Brandon Victor Dixon. And so it's just this crazy that the president-elect has time on his hands to keep bringing this up and tweeting about it. But that's his prerogative if that's how he wants to run his administration.
We also know that there was a group of vigilantes who said that if he did not get elected on November 9th, it was going to be a lot of trouble. So if there was going to be a lot of trouble from that group, I think from our group, a simple speech seems to be quite benign.
And did anyone hear? So now, there's some movement for a quote unquote boycott of Hamilton. Which, I mean, I think laughter is the only response to that. Also, specifically, I heard something about how, I don't think this is a joke, some group of bikers has said they're going to be outside the theater protesting, counter-protesting. Maybe it already happened. Anyone hear?
I haven't heard about the bikers, but I would be very surprised if any sort of boycott or counter protest really took root there. So they can protest if they'd like, if people would like to do that. And there's been lots of offers out there to take any tickets off of anybody's right wing hands that they would have tickets. I think there's many, many takers on Twitter and Facebook for those tickets if you'd like. And as our good friend Robbie Rizal says, how will StubHub ever make it through this crisis? So
I think it's God knows how much of a even further markup those right wingers would want.
Hey, it's free market economy, Michael. It's free market.
That's right.
Yes, and this is just another amazing chapter in the amazing Hamilton story. I mean, it just never ends. That Hamilton still stays in the news, will continue to stay in the news, and makes news.
Our friend Michael Dale, who I saw last night at another show, put a Facebook message with typical wit. He said something like, the only thing that would have been worse is if Pence had had tickets to Waitress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that on Facebook. But I think it'd be great for Pence to go see Falsettos and Waitress and
all of those
and The Great Comet and all those other things. Let's move forward. As you mentioned, Michael, you and Peter did see The Great Comet, and I will be seeing it soon. But Josh Groban was out when both of you saw it, so we will be talking about it in an upcoming show next week and week after. We'll have to see when we can all get to see it with Josh and talk about that a little bit. But the two of you had the opportunity to see our favorite Sutton Foster in Sweet Charity. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with Sweet Charity?
Well, you know, so many musicals are said to have second act trouble. I say the current production of Sweet Charity suffers from first scene trouble.
Oh, that is so interesting, because I go on. Oh, wow. Okay, go on.
All right. Traditionally, Sweet Charity opens with Charity desperately in love with Charlie, though the character in the script is actually known as Dark Glasses, because that's what he wears. And he's very aloof while she's pouring out her heart and talking about how wonderful he is and how their plans for the rest of their life are going to be. And then he this is in Central Park, and he throws her into the pond and steals her handbag, and it's just an indication of what bad luck Charity has with men. Now, in this production, director Lee Silverman thought it was a good idea not to have her just sing to one man, but many men. So the song is split up. If it's AABA, a guy comes in for the first A, then leaves. The second guy comes in for the second A and leaves. The third, et cetera. And this makes her look to me I'm looking for a euphemism for slut, and I can't find one. But that's the problem for me. Charity has to be somebody. Yes, she's been through a lot of men, I'll grant you, but this makes it look like she really has been with far too many, and it's a good idea not to remind us of this, even if this is true. At the end of the show, she does start listing men she's been with, but we expect that she's been through men. I don't think it's a good idea to remind us of that. Now, this is based on a movie called The Knights of Cabiria, which was about a prostitute, and Bob Fosse, when creating the show for his wife Gwen Verdon, was very smart not to make her a prostitute, but a dance hall hostess. That's a few steps up. There used to be these in Times Square. You used to be able to go and dance with women. What happened after that, of course, as they even allude to that in Charity, the extracurricular activities. We never get the impression that Charity really has, shall we say, turned tricks. Not really. So the idea of reminding us that she has been with so many men, I think, is a really big problem. To establish that she's devoted to one man is and then get stumped is a very different set of circumstances. So I think that's very important. I don't think this is Sutton Foster's shining moment. I don't think she really has found the character, and I think a lot of it has to do with the direction, where she has been asked to play it as far more knowing, far more harsh, far more, yeah, just tough. I mean, realistic, I'll grant you, but again, this is a musical comedy, and playing it this realistic and grittier makes it far less savory. Now, the thing about this realism that pops in, I don't understand why, and this goes back to Bob Fosse even, I don't understand why, if the show is called Sweet Charity, why there's so much severity in the character to begin with. And what I'm talking about specifically, she's got a tattoo in her arm. Now, back in 1966, there were very few women who had tattoos. And while it's a nice way of showing that she's devoted to her boyfriend, women didn't get tattoos. You look at that original logo of Gwen Verdon with one arm akimbo in that black dress, and does that really spell out Sweet to you? Take a look at the Subway ads that where Sutton Foster gives us a very stern look. And is that Sweet to you? I think so many directors want to make musicals dark. I like dark musicals. And that's, I think, a way of people saying musicals aren't, I'm not frivolous for liking musicals, because if I like dark musicals, well, then I'm serious, you know. So, but not every show should be dark. And I think darkening this one has been a titanic mistake. So I was very disappointed with that. But needless to say, it's very hard to top Bob Fosse's choreography, and in The Rich Man's Frug, there isn't much of an attempt to do that. There were three separate sections in the original, and they've been mashed together. I do like the idea that she's in a lavender dress as opposed to a black dress, because that does soften the character quite a bit. So I've never heard Neil Simon lines get so little response, and I will concede that may very well be the fact that people know them. I don't think so. I think it's really that they're not delivered in a funny way. So so that's a problem for me, too. I hated the scene in which Charity must make a swift exit into Vittorio Vidal's costume. He picked her up at a nightclub just to make his girlfriend jealous, who had been giving him some grief. Okay, so now the girlfriend is arriving at their place, at his place, and Charity knows she's got to get into that closet so that she won't be discovered. And there's a scene where Sweet Charity takes her sweet time in choosing what bread she's going to take in the closet to eat. She butters it slowly. And then, to be perfectly frank, you should pardon the expression, we see her eat like a pig and then stare out of the closet at the sex between the two lovers. Now, originally, Charity peeked through a keyhole for a few moments and then let the lovers be. But this Charity is such a voyeur as she somehow finds a pair of what look like to me binoculars and watches. The lighting is so embarrassed that it fades out, but not our peeping Charity. So, in short, I mean, there's in the famous if they could see me now number, she has a cane, a hat and cane, and with the cane she twirls it around like a baton, and she's very adept at that. But I think the baton should have been passed to someone else, who could be directed to play Sweet Charity in a sweeter way.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
That's a very neat turn of phrase there, Peter.
Thank you. Every now and then.
When the last revival of Sweet Charity happened with Christina Applegate, as some people may recall, Miss Applegate at one point broke her foot. I think that's what happened.
Something like that, yeah.
And so I actually wound up seeing the show out of town in Boston with Charlotte d'Amboise. Before I later saw it on Broadway with Christina Applegate. And when I saw it in Boston, I was struck by the fact that the overture did not start with the famous bop, 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 bop. And I thought, well, that is so iconic. Why would they cut that? And I remember mentioning it in some kind of a review that I did of that production with Charlotte d'Amboise. And by the time the show came to Broadway, that music was back. So I don't know if I had any hand in that, but I always like to think that maybe I helped a little bit. This production also does not start with that music. And that was my first clue that maybe this was going to be something I wasn't going to like. And then absolutely, Peter, the whole point of that whole first scene is that Charity is fixated on this Charlie guy, and that's the name of the tattoo that she has on her arm.
Yes, it is. Mm.
And it's supposed to be – the whole point of the show is supposed to be that although her work involves her being intimate on some level with all of these men, that in her personal life what she really wants is to love one man and get married and live a traditional monogamous life of that sort. So I don't know what they were thinking with having three or four different guys seen with her during that opening number. The only thing I could say in their defense, Lee Silverman's defense, and maybe Josh Bergassi, the choreographer, maybe he had something to do with it. I suppose we're supposed to think that that's happening over a period of time.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
Yeah. But still.
Still.
It's still confusing because I don't think the audience necessarily gets, we don't know how long it's supposed to be. She certainly doesn't change costume or anything. And by the way, she stays in the same ugly purplish costume for most of the show, which was another of the many mistakes here. But then in the subsequent scene with her friends Helene and Nikki in the dance hall, she's talking only about Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And who is supposed to be one of these guys that she's seen with, because he is Joel Perez, who plays like five roles. That's one of the roles that he's credited with. So we see her with three or four guys, and then suddenly she's talking about her, the man she considered her fiance, and making excuses for how she must have tripped and fallen into the pond in Central Park. But he's going to call. Oh, he's going to call. He's going to call. So that didn't make any sense whatsoever. And I'm not sure why they did that. Then just to skip to the end of the show, I thought Sutton Foster was, even if miscast, I thought she was doing quite a good job in terms of acting. But when, eventually Charity meets this Oscar guy played by Shuler Hensley, and it seems like it's really true love, finally. And at first she's worried about him finding out what she does for a living, but then she tells him, and he says it doesn't matter. So she really thinks she's happy, and this is the man, and she's going to live that life she always wanted. But then at the you know, at the last minute, he decides he can't deal with it, her past. And so he leaves her basically, although it's not staged realistically here, by also throwing her in a fountain or a lake in Central Park. And it just did not seem to me that she was terribly upset by being left by this man. Whereas in the movie, for example, with Shirley MacLaine and John McMartin, that scene is absolutely devastating. So I don't know. Maybe it was some female empowerment thing that they were going for. And also in that regard, I had to go away for a minute. Peter, did you talk about the change in the ending?
No. This show has had more endings than FDR had presidential administrations. I mean, there has never, ever been a satisfying ending to Sweet Charity, starting from the literally sitcom ending that the original had. I think the most successful was the one that in the Christine Applegate version. This one, to me, makes very little sense. How about you?
Well, again, I think it was supposed to be that she's finally going to do some self-examination. It ends with her repeating that line from the opening number. You should see yourself, take a mirror, man, and reflect yourself.
Sure.
I guess we think that we're supposed to think that she's really going to pull herself up by the bootstraps and look and see what her issues are and not kind of keep doing this. I don't know, but
no, I think that's what they were going for. Yeah. Exactly. You know, I mean, she's saying, where am I going at the end of the show now? And then, as you say, repeated those lines from the opening number that she referred to originally, Charlie Dark Glasses. And now she was referring to herself. But to me, that seems more like a first act curtain.
Yeah, I didn't mind the moving of where am I going to later in itself. But the other stuff, I don't think was, as Peter said, there's never been a satisfying ending.
Never.
But this one wasn't either. I will say overall that I thought that it was not the show was not as darkened as I feared it would be. There was still a lot of humor in it. I'm sure Peter would agree with that. And so in that sense, it was successful. Also, I think because, as I said to someone, because it was written by Cy Coleman, who had really major roots in jazz, the mm-hmm. score, it seemed to me, reduced very well in terms of number of instruments. It was basically sort of like a jazz band. There were some reeds in there and there was an organ, but it was mostly a rhythm section. And I didn't really feel like I missed too much. I mean, of course, we didn't get the trumpets playing that famous bump, bump, bump. And maybe that's why they cut it at the beginning. Of course, it's still in Big Spender. So I would say that was also good. I thought Shuler Hensley was wonderful. He played it very, very differently from anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a mistake to have Joel Perez. Well, he, as I said, he played Charlie, but that turned out to be just a walk-on.
Walk-on, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I thought he was excellent as Vittorio Vidal.
I did too.
But really wrong for a Daddy Brubeck, because I just don't think he has that type of voice, and wrong for Herman in terms of his age, his type, his look. So I don't know why he played all of those roles. I guess maybe there were several men in the ensemble that I might have thought would have been able to take one of those roles as primarily Daddy Brubeck, but I don't know why that didn't happen.
I adored him as Vittorio Vidal because we should only hope that movie stars are human beings to this degree. I think that's a fabulous thing. In the movie, we'll talk about the best worst thing that ever could have happened. Jason Alexander makes a reference to the fact, when I leave the house, I say to myself, I'm on, because he knows people are going to come up to him. This portrayal of Vidal certainly had humanity and at every turn. So I like that. But you're quite right about his not I hate when I say you're quite right. I agree with you that he was terribly wrong for Hermann, who's actually referred to once as the Führer and another time as Hitler. And he wasn't remotely that type of person at all. So so I do feel that. But I think the best Vittorio Vidal I've ever seen. And I also like, by the way, the decision to have Ursula join in on Too Many Tomorrows. Why not? Why not?
Yeah, no, I think Vittorio is an important character because we do need to see some people be nice to charity. And also, just quickly, Nikki was Asmeret Gebremichael.
Gebremichael,
thank you.
I thought she was terrific.
And Emily Padgett was Helene, and I thought that they were both fantastic.
Yeah, Nikki was a real human being too. I mean, so I really like that. I have to admit too, even at the end of the show, where they have the party for charity, there's always been a moment where they're reading a tribute to her, and Helene breaks down in tears, and then I'm sorry, Nikki breaks down in tears, and then Helene does too, and that was always played for comic effect. In the original and subsequent shows. But this one, I think, really was really nice that they really had real emotion there. So I like that very much. When it got emotional, that's fine. When it got hard bitten. And Michael, you know, I'm sorry, but I have to disagree with you about that vamp, because I think, again, a show called Sweet Charity, that vamp, though magnificent as vamps go and one of the great in Broadway history, essentially says, when you start the overture with that, this is going to be a tough show. So,
I mean, I think they're trying to show us the sex and also the other side of charity. That's why the famous photo of Gwen Verdon that you alluded to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they were trying to sell sex at the same time as showing. So in a sense, it's you might say cross purposes, but
yeah.
But that's what charity does, but that's not what she really is.
Mm-hmm.
So I see what you mean. But you know what? I think final statement that I remember, it must have been, well, one of the revivals years ago, Ken Mandelbaum wrote something to the effect of how Sweet Charity has had a much longer and more fruitful life than anyone might have thought when the original production was on. And a lot of people really just thought of it as a vehicle for Gwen Verdon and, of course, Bob Fosse. But it has had a very, very wonderful and expansive life in terms of many, many productions, including several major ones in New York. And I think it is because it's based on a really great movie that everyone should see, Knights of Cabiria, and that Neil Simon, who wrote the book, and Cy Coleman, and the great Dorothy Fields, who wrote the lyrics, did a very, very wonderful job in adapting it to the musical stage and making it something very, very, very different from that original movie, but well worthwhile on its own.
Okay, on that level, let's also point out that Charity opened in January of 66, produced by Friar Karen Harris, who also in May of 66 produced Mame. Mm-hmm. And because Mame got better reviews and wound up running more than twice as long as Charity, Friar Karen Harris really paid much more attention to Mame than they did to Charity. And Fosse was furious about that, mm-hmm. furious that they were making his show second best. So, but the history of Charity, you're right, has been substantially stronger than that of Mame. We've only had one Mame Broadway revival, which lasted a very short period of time, while we've had two long-running Charities on Broadway, and here it shows up again, and you don't see Mame very much anymore, but Charity seems to come back.
And from the beginning, there was fear that it would not outlive Gwen Verdon, but starting right at the beginning, they started to have amazing other charities as replacements and or on tour, including Cheetah Rivera, Juliet Prowse, Helen Gallagher did it at one point, didn't she?
I saw her do it, in fact. Yeah. She subbed for a week, and she was terrific, too.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of time on charity, and we
Didn't
had to
we?
get a lot in, but two quick things about charity before we move on to the next topic. What do you quick answer from both of you. Do you think this will transfer to Broadway? It's right now off Broadway.
I do not.
Michael?
I think it might, but I don't know if if it should. I'm just reading about a transfer. I don't know if it's based on anything.
Right.
All right. And the last thing is that the new group's production of Sweet Charity is playing at the Romulus Linney Courtyard Theater at the Pershing Square Signature Center, which is almost as long as Shuffle Along's title.
With an all-female band, by the way.
Oh, really? I didn't hear that. It's playing through January 8th, 2017, and ticket prices are already at the Broadway level. Lowest price is $95, up to $175.
Wow, it's a very small theater, so I can understand from the producer's vantage point how getting some money in there is really necessary, considering how small it is. When I went there, I expected it to be in the bigger theater, the biggest theater, I should say. There are a lot of them there, but that's where Master Harold is, so which is kind of surprising because that's a small show. But Charity's in a very small space.
All right. Next up, we are going to talk about Finian's Rainbow at the Irish Repertory Theater. In comparison, the new Irish remodel, how does that compare in size to the new group's production of Sweet Charity?
Well, it surprised me. I fully expected that I don't know if anybody's been to the Irish Rep who's listening to us, but it's an L-shaped space, or at least it was.
Yeah.
And I fully expected it was just going to be widened. What they essentially did is add a balcony, which is kind of cute, and it's an intimate space. But anyway, those seats off to the side are gone. So the stage has been slightly expanded, but I can't say that they used it terribly much at Irish Rep. Anyway, this is a marvelous production. It's been tremendously cut down. The book has been tremendously cut down by Charlotte Moore, who's directed as well. And I can't say I really felt that I lost anything that I knew of. Very successful. Melissa Errico, who, by the way, if they ever make a movie biography of Bette Davis, she should play it. There really is an analogy in the way she looks, the way Bette Davis looked. Here she is many years later, and she certainly doesn't look any worse for wear in playing the lead role, which is a wonderful role. She gets to sing How Are Things in Glacamora and Look to the Rainbow, which are marvelous songs. This really, one of the things you take away from this production is you're reminded once again that Finian's Rainbow really is one of the great scores of all time.
Yes.
And musically, it's lovely. I mean, the lyrics are astonishing because E.Y. Harburg made his own rules in terms of words. He enjoyed very much playing around with words. And so you hear a lot of words that the people really don't say. I'm laughing because I'm thinking of when my son was very little and fell in love with The Wizard of Oz. You know, he would always sing any individual. And I remember saying, "Do you know what that means?" And he'd say, "No," you know, but he just enjoyed the word. So, you know, we have Hell Collateral, relative, Rockefellative, rules with animules, meaning animals, you know, all that kind of stuff. But really, I came away saying, you know, as much as I've always loved the Finian's Rainbow score, and it was one of the first original cast albums I ever heard, by the way, I really have to place it in the top 10. I just do. So it's really a pleasure to hear one spectacular song after the other. So that's the real strength of this production. Even though it's really extraordinarily successful on every level, and I'm delighted that they brought it back. In a way, it seemed like it was a little too soon to bring it back because it was only 8 years ago. But of course, as I always say in things like, it was 12 years ago. Boy, does time go fast. Anyway, because as I always say, even though when people complain about revivals, oh, they're bringing that back again, that's us. You know, those are the people who go to the theater all the time. But In reality, the general public often misses shows because they can't get there in time, or they haven't saved enough money for a ticket because they're all so expensive. So anyway, Ryan Silverman is very good as Woody, who does fall in love with Sharon. They're fated to be mated, and I will admit that the story gets a little convoluted. It's sort of hard to explain. There's something in the structure that's really odd. There's a big song at the beginning this time of year where everybody's going, Woody's coming, Woody's coming, Woody's coming, Woody's here. And then all of a sudden you see two people arrive and you assume one of them's Woody. No, it isn't. That's Finian and his daughter Sharon. I think the movie is very successful in having them start the movie and then go to the scene where Woody's coming, Woody's here, and then Woody is there. You know, so it's a little convoluted. And the story's a little tough now and then to really establish the fact that Finian's has stolen a pot of gold, and certainly a leprechaun named Og is none too happy about this. So it's, but of course, the thing that Finian's always gets criticized for today, and unjustly so. So many people think it's racist because what happens is that Senator Rockins, who's very red state and very redneck, is somebody who is very anti-black and anti-immigrant, which is kind of interesting today, too. Mm. You know, the immigrants have been giving my family trouble ever since we came over here is one of the funny lines refers to. And so anyway, when Sharon says, I wish you were black, in fact, the pot of gold carries with it three wishes, and he becomes black. And some people really misunderstand that what he's really getting is a dose of his own medicine. A book was written around the same time called Black Like Me, and where a guy purposely took some sort of medication to make his skin black to see how people would treat him, and really got an eye-opening experience. So it's an eye-opening experience for Senator Rockins too. And I really am very surprised when people think it's a racist thing. It's if anybody was not racist, if anybody was humanitarian, it was E.Y. Harbor, probably the most humanitarian writer we ever had. Mm-hmm. And one of the great lyrics in Finian's Rainbow is not a clever one. In that great Come and Get It Day song, at the end, you know, we'll get it, we'll keep it, we'll share it. That's what's so wonderful. We'll share it. That if essentially saying if the middle classes had money, it wouldn't automatically want to turn into one of the one percenters, that it would be generous with what it had. And that's a lovely thought, and I hope it's true. So a very successful Finian's Rainbow. It doesn't get done that often, despite the Irish rep. So it's a good time to get there. And if you do not know this score, You must indeed. There are so many cast albums of it. I guess, you know, you always fall in love with the one you hear first. And even though I said it was the original cast album I heard first, no, it wasn't. It was the 1960 album with Jeannie Carson, which I prefer. I find Ella Logan on the original very mannered. That's an opinion that some people share and a lot don't. But 1960 revival cast album is the one I like.
All right, Michael, what do you think?
I think the people who think Finian's Rainbow is racist are the same people who think that the Scottsboro Boys is racist.
Yeah.
And I just think that if people are going to express that opinion, it indicates a lack of understanding that's kind of shocking. So that's my opinion. I completely agree on the score. I believe that Burton Lane wrote full scores for only three Broadway shows. Wish he had written more because, man. I mean, to sit there and listen to these incredible songs one after the other. And, you know, the comedy numbers are as great as the ballads, which are as great as the production numbers. Every style, every part of it is wonderful. Peter, did you ever hear the rumor that Finian's was actually two different scripts put together?
No, but I have no problem believing it.
Yeah, I just recently heard that. I was reminded that some people think that's true because, it, in a way, it seems like there's this one story about the leprechaun and who gets his crock of gold stolen, and it sort of seems like, in a way, that it's grafted onto this other story about these sharecroppers and this bigoted senator. But if that is true, I think that they wound up actually putting them together really well. Beautiful production sets, costumes. And one thing I wanted to mention is that when this production was first done 12 years ago, as Peter has mentioned, it was recorded with two pianos. And that's a lovely recording to listen to. It's just lovely and simple and beautiful. And Melissa's voice is great. And Max von Essen is on that recording. But this production has piano, bass, violin, and harp, orchestrated by Josh Clayton. And I almost wish they would record it again because it sounds so beautiful in that space. And we spoke to Melissa briefly afterwards because I know her fairly well. And I said, aside from everything, it was so wonderful to get to hear you sing unamplified. And, you know, because we don't really get that. And she said, yeah. And I really have to obviously do different things than I would normally. I have to face forward and do a lot of moving forward towards the audience. But everyone in it had a real voice, certainly Ryan Silverman, and this guy, Mark Evans, who I didn't know previously, who plays Og. And the chorus, you know, although fairly small, the ensemble sounded roof raising in that intimate space. So bravo on the renovations, which were long overdue, and I'm so glad they brought this show back. Because also, yeah, the other thing Peter didn't mention, aside from the fact that the theater is still quite small, both of these runs have been and will be limited. So it's not as if everybody gets a chance to see Finian's Rainbow who wants to. So now there's a whole new, hopefully larger, much larger group of people who get to experience this magnificent show in a beautiful production.
I'm also ashamed that I didn't mention Ken Jennings, who's marvelous as Finian.
Yeah,
you may know him from Nothing's Gonna Harm You, Not While I'm Around. He was the original Tobias and Sweeney Todd, and now he's playing the crusty but lovable Finian, and does a spectacular job of it.
And for whatever reason, has not done a lot since then, except the notable exception being You're in Town, which was great.
Yeah.
All right. So that's really exciting that we have another great production of Finian's Rainbow to see. And this was born out of the concert fundraiser for Irish Rep that helped us get straighten out that L shape a little bit, you know, just to make it and bring that balcony in. And I want to mention that Finian's Rainbow pricing is $50 to $70. So quite affordable.
One of the best bargains in New York. I mean, I can't tell you how much I loved it.
Oh, that's great. Also, next up, Michael and Peter got a chance to see The Front Page on Broadway. They didn't force you to go opening night and run back to your typewriters, did they?
No. They didn't care that much about what I had to think.
All right. So, Michael, why don't you just get us started on this one?
Well, yeah, I'll try to be brief. I did this show in high school.
Who were you?
I was Robert Morris.
Uh-huh.
I was Pincus. And that was my only experience of it until seeing it again now on Broadway. I don't even know the film His Girl Friday, which is an adaptation of it in which the gender of one of the main characters is switched. Rosalind Russell plays Hildy. Hildy is the person's name even when he's a man. It's supposed to be Hildebrand, and he's supposed to be, I guess, Swedish. They keep calling him that damn Swede. But in the movie, she's still called Hildy, but I guess not Hildebrand, maybe Hildegard. I don't know.
Yeah, indeed.
So it was weird for me to be there and hear, you know, these lines again after, I mean, my God, we did it and it would have been like 1973. So that so to go that amount of time between experiencing a play was pretty amazing. But you know what? I think that I really did not enjoy this very much, and I think it's mostly because of the play, as heretical as that may seem. I think that the play is – well, I know it's extremely well regarded of its day. Many people consider it a benchmark comedy of the era. But first of all, I don't – I mean, it's not – really a laugh out loud comedy for most of it. I think it's excellent in the way that the authors Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur recreated the patois of these characters, most of whom are reporters in the press room of this criminal court building, I guess. And they're sitting there waiting there because this someone is going to be hung for a crime, and they're there to cover that. And then that person winds up escaping, and things get very, very tense. But I felt like until Nathan Lane's entrance, because he has the amazing ability to be funny sort of outside of the material. He does things that are innately funny in terms of his facial expressions and his inflections, his vocal inflections. But for the first two acts of this three-act play, although I think the dialogue is very clever, I just don't think it's that interesting or funny. And it's such a long play. It's basically 3 hours, almost 3 hours with the two intermissions. And I thought that other than Nathan Lane, the only people who really were able to create any comedy on stage were Robert Morse, Dan Florek, and Micah Stock. Everyone else was doing exactly what they were meant to do, but I just kind of felt like it's this filler dialogue until things finally start happening. And the comedy, such as it is, exists in the relationship between the Nathan Lane character and the John Slattery character, because Nathan Lane is the editor, and John Slattery as Hildy has been the star reporter, and they have a very contentious sort of love-hate relationship that goes back many years, I think 15 years, they say. And so that it's almost like a marriage between the two of them, although Hildy is planning to get married and leave the business. So that's the bone of contention here. So when that starts to happen and when Nathan Lane comes on, I suddenly found it to become very interesting and funny. But until then, I thought it was a very, very long slog. And I don't think it was the production's fault. I don't think it was Jack O'Brien, the director's fault. I just think that's the way the play was written and the style that it was crafted in. And it didn't really work for me anymore.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
Well, he will have to part company because I think, let's put it this way. So many properties deal with love versus career, which is the more important. Annie Get Your Gun does it. Baker Street does it. Can-Can does it. Dreamgirls does it. And we're only starting the alphabet. Nothing does it better than the front page, because here's a man who loves what he does. Hildy Johnson is crazy about the newspaper business, and yet he has fallen in love with Peggy, and as a result, he is leaving the business for her. He is going to work for one of her relatives in the advertising business, and under those circumstances, way down deep, we know he's not crazy about giving up the job that he loves so much. And then, when circumstances arise that he is able to have a real scoop, an astonishing scoop over his fellow reporters, he is more intent on doing that than getting married at the moment. His intentions are still good to his wife, to be, but career takes first place here for a while. Actually, at the end of the show, love triumphs, and I'm not sure it really should on a couple of levels, but especially involved with this production. Speaking of advertising, have you ever heard the word advertising get a big laugh from an audience? Well, it does here, because the gentleman playing Hildy is John Slattery, who was on all 89 episodes of Mad Men. So under those circumstances, people are associating the word advertising with him. Is this why he was cast? I mean, I can't imagine he was cast for any other reason, because I think he's not good at all in the
Agreed.
Role.
Agreed.
Oh, yeah. You know, I hated that he swallowed the play's best line when he's about to leave and go get married, when all of a sudden this big event happens, I'm not going to say what it is, that makes him privy to a scoop. And he calls up his boss, Walter Burns, later to be Nathan Lane, calls up his boss and says, "Don't worry, Walter, I'm on the job." And I'm telling you, John Slattery took it as a throwaway. So it's usually a cry from the heart and soul that really shows Hildy's true colors and how career can even trump love. But frankly, he just looks too old for the part, too.
Yes.
When Pat O'Brien played it in 1931, he was 30 years old. Slattery's 54 now, and frankly looks older because of his gray hair. He seems like he's close to retirement age, which lessens his being so valuable to the newspaper. But even worse, there's a moment where he accuses his fellow reporters of being nobodies and says that the day will come when you'll be on the copy desk and gray-haired. Well, that's the elephant calling the kangaroo gray. I mean, so, and then, you know, Hallie Pfeiffer, who isn't even 32 yet and looks younger. So the 22-year age difference makes the age difference seem even stronger. Hector MacArthur wanted to write a May-December romance, but this one seems like April-January. So that's a problem. But also, I think Jack O'Brien made a big mistake with her, because he's directed her to be very shrewish. And as a result, we don't want Hildy to leave the paper and get married to her. Mm. Now, to be fair, the script has her at nonstop odds with her fiance's priorities. But, you know, a catch more flies with honey approach is really needed here. She needs to make soft-pedaled requests and not unfeeling ultimatums. So, and what's really problem is, after we see her be so shrewish, you know, then Hildy later says she's the most wonderful girl I've ever known. They come like that once in a man's life. She never complained. That's all she did was complain. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't work on that level either. So it's fun to see some of the minor players, actually. I agree with Michael that the minor players shine. I'll mention Dylan Baker, who I didn't even recognize for a few moments. He really got into his character that much. And Louis J. Stadlin understands this type of comedy from way back when. Mm. He's the son of Alan Swift, who was around for that time. And I think he might well have taught him, if not everything he knows, a good deal of what he knows. Because Louis Stadlin, since his big breakout role as Groucho Marx in Minnie's Boys, has been somebody who shows that he understands comedy from that era extraordinarily well. So he's really, every line he gets, and he doesn't get as many as I'd like him to get, is delivered with pinpoint precision. So I also, you know, Robert Morse is too old too. I mean, yes. You know, he's 85 years old now, and he talks about being the father of high schoolers, you know, yeah. So that's a problem as well. Also, you know, I will admit, I checked the script. He comes back. He has a very important role, as it turns out, and gives some salient information. And I will admit that the stage direction do state that he enters stewed, meaning drunk. But, you know, I would have gone easier on this, because he has important information, and if he's too drunk, which is the way O'Brien has him, then he wouldn't be believed, and he needs to be believed. All in all, it's wonderful that the front page is produced, because there are so many people on stage. It's a very elaborate set, and it's just a shame that it didn't turn out to be better than it is. And so while I'm nitpicking, there are nits to pick.
Yeah, I don't know. It sounds like maybe, though, that maybe you don't completely disagree with me that a lot of the issues are in the play itself.
I don't feel as strongly about that as you. I look at this glass as half full with the objections you're making. But anyway, you know, we can't agree on everything.
No, but also the but those people, I certainly agree. Those people who play the reporters, I mean, you can't get much better aside from the ones you mentioned. We have David Pitou, we have Christopher McDonald, Joey Slotnick, Clark Thorell, and Jefferson Mays. And it's, you know, I mean, they were all fantastic. It's just that the dialogue, it's not, nothing happens. Until
it happens. By the way, in your performance, did Jefferson Mays get entrance applause because people thought he was Nathan Lane?
Yes, and apparently it's been happening consistently. I'm amazed that they haven't done anything to work against it. All they if they just had him take his hat off as he was entering, I think that would solve it. But I guess they don't feel it necessary to solve it.
The best story involves when Nathan Lane was out the other night, and a friend was telling me that his friend said to him, gee, we saw the front page last night, and Nathan Lane was marvelous. And the guy said, no, Nathan Lane was out last night. Oh, no, he wasn't. No, he wasn't, because they really thought Jefferson
was. Oh, boy.
So, which is kind of funny.
All right. So the front page is playing at the Broadhurst on 44th Street through January 29th. It's a limited engagement, so they say. And we'll have to see if they think about extending. Can they extend? Is something else coming into the Broadhurst? I can't remember off the top of my head. I'm still fuzzy from my vacation.
Not sure.
I'm not either.
All right. So let's move forward into the Classic Stage Company's production of Dead Poets Society. Michael and Peter both got a chance to see it. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with Dead Poets?
Well, I have the problem with Dead Poets that I have with Terms of Endearment down at 59 East 59th. You know, I don't understand why we're bringing these movies to the stage. It makes no sense to me. And this may be the closest screenplay to play ever, because there are many word-for-word sequences that are there. And that's not surprising, because Tom Schulman, who wrote the screenplay for the 1989 movie, is the playwright here, too. So I guess he felt he hadn't made enough from his cash cow and had to birth a cash calf. I don't know. Anyway, so there we are. It's 1959. We're in Welton Academy, the best prep school in the United States, insists headmaster Paul Nolan. He makes the boys recite the school's mantra: tradition, honor, discipline, and excellence. Of course, the moment Nolan leaves the classroom, the five students we meet, as opposed to six in the film, by the way, are no better than the kids at Grease Rydell High, who parody their official school song. You know, the Welton boys see their lives as tragedy, horror, decadence, and excrement. So they're ripe for an adventurous teacher, and here comes Mr. Keating, who just can't wait to try out his unorthodox method. Jason Sudeikis, is that how it's pronounced? I don't know.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay. Has this Robin Williams role, and I think he's splendid in creating the teacher you always wanted to have and love but never did. Or if you had one as good, Sudeikis will make you nostalgic for him or her. So that part of the show is very successful. Words and ideas can change the world, he states. And soon he has the kids getting excited, noisy, and out of their seats. Listen, I used to be a high school teacher, and I used to do that too, and the headmaster hated me for it as well. So I understand the notion, and perhaps even a pipe dream of getting kids to respond in a way that you want them to, and getting mixed results from it. So I do like that Nolan, David Garrison, who's really quite wonderful, isn't one-dimensional. We see he's out for the students' best welfare when he warns Mr. Keating that such methods will keep the kids from making a living, you know. But he's not as ferocious as one of the kids' fathers. And I think you know that when a father gets too severe in a play like this and the kid has to buckle down and do what the father says, even when he finds something he really loves, which is acting, which we all understand, I think we know what's going to happen when the father makes him drop out of the play. It's a little predictable, even if you haven't seen the original movie. So I don't know. You know, Amazon Video has did Poet Society available for $2.99, and I hate to tell you what you have to pay for the for this play in terms of endearments. So I don't know why we're doing this. I think it's a big mistake to put fine movies on stage.
All right, Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, and also in so many cases, these movies when they that originate as movies, they have very famous actors in often iconic portrayals, whether it be Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society or Shirley MacLaine in Terms of Endearment. And then there's all that baggage that these actors have to deal with. I mean, that can happen also in plays that originate as plays and are then made as movies so that the general public gets to associate a role with someone. But I think it's even worse in something that starts as a movie. That said, I think Jason Sudeikis did a wonderful job, very, very different from Robin Williams. I remember seeing the movie when it came out, and I actually interviewed Robert Sean Leonard at that shortly after that time, who plays Neil Perry, the boy who decides he wants to be an actor. And I remember how very incredibly upset I was by the movie because of what Neil's fate turns out to be. But I also felt that even though things like that certainly happen in real life, I think it's handled somewhat manipulatively in the movie and now in this play version. And I wish also that maybe the father could have been a little less of a villain, a little more well-rounded. That's always what I felt about it. And my biggest problem with this production, I have to say, is that the fellow who played Neil, his name is Thomas Mann.
Yeah, not, how about that? Huh?
Not to be confused with the 1929 Nobel Prize literature winner, German novelist, short story writer, social critic, and philanthropist. But anyway, Thomas Mann, gosh, Peter, it did not seem to me that he was that devastated when the father lowered the boom. And so his subsequent action didn't really ring true to me. So I don't know if that was John Doyle, director John Doyle's choice, said maybe he said, don't make it weepy. Maybe that's what happened with Sutton Foster in that final scene in Sweet Charity too. Mm-hmm. Maybe people are being directed not to indulge, you know, not to really let their emotions come through in these scenes, but I think it was a very big mistake in this case. And there are also I have problems with the ending of the script of Dead Poets Society in terms of how at first well, not to get into details, but at first all the boys sort of betray their teacher, and then suddenly as he's leaving they stand up for him literally on their desks. So I never quite got that that very quick turnaround. So that's another problem I have with it. I think it's very well staged and very well acted in most cases by the largely young cast, but probably, as Peter said, probably not necessary.
All right. So next up, we're going to chug through to the next thing, which is the Labyrinth Theatre Company's production of Homos or Everyone in America, which Michael got a chance to see. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Homos or Everyone in America. I love that title. Mm-hmm. A new play by Jordan Seavey, directed by Mike Donahue. And there are four actors in it, but it's really mostly about two characters, one of whom is called the academic, played by Robin De Jesus, and the other, the writer, Michael Urey, played by Michael Urey. And it follows their relationship between in New York City between 2006 and 2011. But like Plenty, another play that we recently saw, the scenes do not happen in chronological order. They skip around quite a bit. And it can be a little disconcerting while it's happening, and you have to really pay attention to figure out where you are in their relationship between these two men. But I did think that at the end it came together beautifully, and it's about their up and down relationship, the fact that they really love each other, but they have some pretty major differences in terms of their worldviews and various opinions on various things. At one point, they even break up. But then a very unfortunate event occurs, and that brings them back together. So I won't say much more than that. I don't think there was a very heavy point to the play other than to show this chart this relationship between them in a non-chronological order, which did make it more interesting, even if sometimes a little confusing. And I think the greatest assets of this production are two things. The writing of the dialogue is so good by Jordan Seavey. I hope to hear more from him in the future. And also Michael Urey and Ramin de Jesus are two of my favorite actors in the world, and I think they really inhabit these characters. The other two actors, for the record, are Stacey Sargent as Lila and Aaron Costaganis as Dan, but I think they also play some other roles briefly. This production is being done down at the Labyrinth's home at the Bank Street Theater, and the only other thing I want to say is that it's the oddest playing setup I have ever seen in my life, and I also don't know why they did it that way. And also, I must say it that depending on where you're sitting, you may find that your seat is a little precarious because you have to climb up these platforms that don't have a lot of room outside of where the actual folding chairs are. And I did I was sitting next to a railing on the second level, and at one point I turned to the fellow next to me, who was a stranger, and I said, "This is a lawsuit waiting to happen." And he said, "Absolutely." So I don't know why they did that. I wish they hadn't. I wish they had rethought it. It's too late now. But if this play has a future life, I hope they address that issue. Because there are very thick, not even posts, just like supporting pillars in the playing space. And there are some people who have seats behind them and I guess have to look around them in order to see what's happening on the very narrow, long playing area. So I don't know why. I've been in that space before. It's never been set up that way, and I don't know why they did it, and I wish they hadn't. Because it's a really I think the play and the actors are terrific, and I wish it had been given a better showcase in that sense.
I guess the song from the first act finale of Dreamgirls comes to mind for many of us when we hear about seating like that. And I am telling you, I am not going.
Right. So next up, Peter, you got down to the director's company's production of Terms of Endearment at 59 East 59. So what did you think about this yet again, another film adaptation?
Yeah, same thing. You know, I mean, but, you know, this one really played into the fact that it was an adaptation of the movie, because what we also saw was Molly Ringwald, who these days resembles Shirley MacLaine. All right, she's not nearly as old, don't misunderstand me, but there is a resemblance. Not only that, the gentleman who played Garrett Breedlove, the astronaut, originally played by Jack Nicholson, has the exact same pot belly that Jack Nicholson had in the movies. He's very, very good. Don't misunderstand me. This actor, Jeb Brown, is terrific in the role. Molly Ringwald is terrific in the role, too. But I don't understand why we're doing this on stage. Now, this one even suffers more because, to me, when I think of Terms of Endearment, I think of the scene where Deborah Winger brings her two sons into the hospital room and gives them no good news. She never says, I am dying. She never quite says, I love you. She just talks about other things. And the subtext is there, and the boys know they're in trouble, that they're not going to have their mother back. Here what happens is, because we don't have children, which would add to the expense, and a child wrangler as well, well, what you have is the Deborah Winger character telling her mother, I want you to take down a letter. And she essentially says, I love you more than once in the letter. And I understand that. I really do. But it's not nearly as effective as what the movie is. So at least Dead Poets Society stays true to its original source and keeps the strengths of the original source. This one abandons the big strength of its original source and suffers mightily for it. So, again, that movie's available, too, for $2.99 at Amazon. So I would really advise you to do that rather than pay the prices at 50 90s, 59th. Even though it's an accomplished production, it just doesn't pack the wallop that the movie does.
You know, I wanted to ask you something about this production. Did you see who produced this?
No, I didn't notice.
Julian Schlossberg, Roy Furman, Harold Newman, Florence Kaufman, and Andy Tobias.
Yeah, high
Why
power.
Are these five high-powered Broadway
yes,
producers,
indeed.
Tony Award winners?
Yes, indeed.
Producing at 59 East 59.
Yeah, yeah. I guess they really want to not throw good money after bad if it turns out to be bad money. So, yeah, all these shows that have these lofty plans about going to Broadway, I don't know where they're going to go since so many houses are booked and or have shows running in them. So, you know, again, when I look at the Imperial Theater and next door to the left, if you're standing in front of the Imperial, there's nothing there at the moment. There used to be a parking garage. But once upon a time, there was a theater there. And boy, could we use it now, you know, to have
isn't
another
that,
theater on 45th
Isn't that where
Great Street.
Comet put the tent up?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
They actually built their own theater there. Like, damn it, right. We're going to be on Broadway.
Yeah, indeed. But once upon a time, there was a big theater there. Broadway theater, and it's very sad that it's not there because, boy, you know it would be booked if indeed it was still there.
Peter, a couple of weeks ago we had Jennifer Ashley Tepper on while you were, I think you were at Cincinnati for the weekend. And, oh my goodness, what a great conversation we've had with her. We're so sorry we weren't able to be here at the same time, but we're going to get her back on and we're going to have a fun time talking about all these past, present, and possibly future theaters that we'll have on Broadway. All right. Next up, let's talk about the Merrily We Roll Along documentary, which is called Best Worst Thing That Ever Could Have Happened. And Michael and Peter both got a chance to see that. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, actually, this is a twisting of a lyric that's in the first act finale, in which Franklin Shepard's friends are telling him that his divorce is the best thing that ever could have happened. The reason the word worst is in there is because this is a documentary about all the kids who thought that they were going to have a great life in the theater because Stephen Hall, who had just done Sweeney Todd, had picked them for their new show. And I'll tell you, I really mean this. I don't know if anybody had the experience I had, but I'm so glad I did. I went to the first preview when the curtain went up on those kids and they looked cocky as hell that they were going to be stars. And then I went to the final performance, the closing performance. Now, we're talking about between October 8th and November 28th. And the curtain went up and those kids looked shell-shocked. The thing they'd been talking and bragging to their friends about for a year and a half, suddenly Monday it was the unemployment line. So that's basically what happens in the movie. You see the dreams not just deferred, as we hear in Raisin in the Sun, but smashed beyond recognition. And so the perceptions are there. And I defy any musical theater fan, especially a Merrily fan, and many of us are, not to cry copiously when you're at this picture, which I did. Lonnie Price has done a wonderful job. It's so great to see so much archival footage that I didn't know existed. And here, there, and everywhere. So we see from a lot of people who are involved, we don't see from some people we would have expected to see. I have no idea why Liz Calloway is not in the movie. I don't know if she was out of town. I don't know if she just didn't want to do it. Who knows? I'm just as Andrea McArdle is not in the Annie documentary Life After Tomorrow. I don't know the reasons for this, but they're not there and they're conspicuously absent in these properties. But what is there is terrifically choice. And again, if you do not cry at this movie, I don't want to know you.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
I had a very similar reaction. You know who else is missing that I really thought would be there is Ted Sperling, who was in the original cast and now has become a very famous, successful Broadway musical director. I mean, conductor, musical director, and also occasional director, too.
And what is interesting is that James Weissenbach is in the picture. And he was the original Franklin Shepard, and he was fired. And to think that somebody who has a bad history with Merrily would be willing to talk is really pretty impressive.
I actually got to speak with him on the phone a year or two ago because he's now an agent.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
And he was very nice. So that was great to see him. He still looks great, I have to say.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
For someone who's not still an actor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I loved the movie. I think when Jen Tepper was on the podcast a few weeks ago, she mentioned that she had some involvement with the movie. And I think it was in terms of finding or collating this amazing footage that they found, which was originally done by ABC TV, all these interviews and audition footage and rehearsal footage, because they were planning to do a documentary on the show, which they assumed was going to be a huge hit and then was not. And just to have that footage was incredible. I do think that Lonnie Price made a mistake in that he actually shows his interview that was done back then twice. He shows it at the very beginning of the film and then again at the end. I think it would have been much more effective if we didn't see it till the end. But other than that, I think he did a wonderful job of just what he decided to film, the talking heads that we have now, the way everything was put together, the narrative of the story. I thought there were moments when I felt it was maybe a little bit too much about him, but then he really did expand it to include a lot of material involving Anne Morrison and Jim Walton and James Weissenbach and some of the other major players. Sondheim and Hal Prince are in it in new interviews as talking heads, and it's invaluable to have them. I did think that we didn't need to see them both in extreme close-up, but but it was great to have them and hear their current thoughts on what happened all those years ago in 1981. I won't say much more. I loved it. I think it's required viewing. There were many moments when I teared up. The only thing I will say is, you know, I thought Jason Alexander came across very, very badly. I've had negative feelings about him ever since. I will never forget when Jerome Robbins Broadway was happening, and there was a big article about how they had to basically beg him to be in it. And he just seems to have this very, very odd attitude of entitlement and just a very, very unpleasant attitude towards his abilities and his stardom. Aside from the fact that there's this very weird thing where much of the footage in the movie has him in his natural state, which is mostly bald. And then there are other the talking head scenes, the interviews, where he has a very unconvincing toupee on. And I'm not sure what the deal is with that. So I didn't think he came across well in what he said about the experience and his perception of himself. And but even though I think that's true, to have it in there is interesting in itself, because he, of course, went on to incredible fame on Seinfeld. And it's just amazing the different paths that people's lives take. And that's actually a big part of the movie. It follows the people in their later lives and what they became, in many, many cases, not staying in the acting profession.
All right. So we're running a little long, but Michael, I know that you saw three different shows that we want to touch on briefly. You saw Cheetah Nowadays at Carnegie Hall. You saw William Michaels at Feinstein's 54 Below, and Aida at the Metropolitan Opera. So why don't you give us a few minutes on that?
Yes, Cheetah's concert at Carnegie was amazing, and it was the night before the election, so I'm glad we got to enjoy it before the world fell apart. Nobody ever dreamed, you know, of course, what was going to happen. It had a wonderful 12-piece orchestra with Michael Patrick Walker as the musical director. The guests were fantastic. Alan Cumming showed up to do – he must have been in his glory, because he did two duets with Cheetah, The Apple Doesn't Fall from the Rink in the Liza Minnelli role, and Nowadays from Chicago. I guess you could also say in the Liza Minnelli role, because she played Roxy briefly. Stevie Van Zandt was a guest, and he came and played while Cheetah sang The Secret of Life, the James Taylor song. Andy Carl was on hand to do Rosie from Bye Bye Birdie with her, because I guess maybe Dick Van Dyke is a little past that at this point. Four male dancers. Itzhak Perlman was a surprise guest. He came out and played violin while Cheetah sang Crazy Carousel, the Jacques Brel song. And the Gay Men's Chorus, all whatever, 150 of them came out and added their voices to Somewhere from West Side Story, which, you know, again, had we known what was going to happen the next day, it would have been even more poignant. But as it was very affecting. So I was really glad I saw that. Aida at the Met is one of the few really magnificent older productions that they have. Sonia Frisell, production by Sonia Frisell, set designs by Gianni Quaranta, costume designs by Dada Salieri, lighting by Gil Wexler. And I would say to anyone who wants to see one opera at the Met, this would be a really good choice in terms of the incredible spectacle, also the beauty of the score by Verdi. And it's interesting. I think Donald Trump would have felt very at home in this production, because they had several Russian singers in the leads. But that's maybe a bad joke. But the Aida, Lyudmila Monastirska, was really exceptional. So I'm glad I got to see her. I had never heard of or seen her before, and I think that she has an amazing career ahead of her. And then just briefly, I saw our friend William Michaels do a show at Feinstein's 54 Below called A Baritone on Broadway, and he did a really terrific show. A lot of things you would expect to hear. He absolutely sang Some Enchanted Evening from South Pacific, a role that he played on Broadway in the most recent fabulous Lincoln Center production. And he also sang This Nearly Was Mine from that show, which he identified as what he thinks is the jewel of that score. Then he did songs from Kismet and Paint Your Wagon. Also Oklahoma. And he sang Stars from Les Mis, a role he has done. Where's the Girl from Scarlet Pimpernel, also a role he has done. Chauvelin and Old Man River. And it's always great to hear that quality of a voice in that kind of a venue. In this case, he did use a mic. He didn't sing unplugged, but it was a really great evening and very full. And I said to him afterwards, I said, next time Sweeney Todd, because I had seen him do that entire role, and he was really one of the best I've ever seen. So yeah, if he does his show again, try to be there. It's really, really worth it.
All right. So before we wrap up for the day and get to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device. iHeartRadio also plays us. You can find us on iTunes, Google Play, and anywhere else you can listen to finer podcasts. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, can be found at BroadwayRadio.com in our show notes as well. So, Peter, help us out with the answer from 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I had asked what Tony-nominated musical had an important prop that's also the name of a Broadway theater. And the theater I'm talking about is the Music Box, which is a prop in the Tony-nominated musical She Loves Me. So Jeff Hickman was the first to get it, followed by John Baccarella, Sam Gonzalez, and Deb Popple. So the new question, the opening number of a Sondheim musical actually happens to mention the title of a previous Sondheim musical. What's the name of the song and both Sondheim shows?
All right. So if you know that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, and also like to thank Matt Tamanini for doing Today on Broadway for the last 2 weeks or so, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Devil moon in your eyes. You and your plans make this romance too hot to handle. Stars in the night blazing their light can't hold a candle to your razzle dazzle. You've got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride full of butterflies.
Follow the fellow.